And I want to talk about recent work we've been doing to develop stochastic models of cell cycle regulation in eukaryotes. And as I go along, I'll tell you who's involved in this research program. But first, let me at least acknowledge the groups that have supported this financially, DARPA and the McDonnell Foundation, and now the NIH is supporting this research. Okay, the cell cycle is the sequence of events whereby a growing cell replicates all of its components and divides them more or less evenly between two daughter cells so that the daughters inherit the machinery and the information necessary to repeat the process. And as you know, in eukaryotic cells, the process of DNA replication is separated in time from the segregation of the sister chromatids, so we can divide the eukaryotic cell cycle up into these four phases, S phase, M phase, separated by two gaps, G1 and G2. And the events of the cell cycle are regulated and timed, and the commands are given by these cyclin-dependent kinase proteins, which phosphorylate specific substrates, and then those phosphorylated target proteins drive the events of the cell cycle. So a cyclin B-dependent kinase drives entry into mitosis. Cyclin A-dependent kinase drives DNA synthesis. So the story of the regulation of the events of the cell cycle is the story of the regulation of the activity of these cyclin-dependent kinases. So before I talk about stochastic modeling of the cell cycle, let's first talk about deterministic models. And this work has been done in collaboration over the years with Bela Novak, who's at Oxford University, and Kathy Chen, who's here at Virginia Tech, and Tila Chikosnudj, who's now in Italy, and a number of other people have contributed to this work. The deterministic models are based on this wiring diagram, which is a diagram of the molecular machinery that controls the activity of cyclin B-dependent kinase, cyclin A-dependent kinase, cyclin E-dependent kinase. And in the diagram, chemical reactions are indicated by solid arrows, so synthesis and degradation of this protein CKI, and catalytic reactions are indicated by the dashed line. So, for instance, the cyclin B-dependent kinase phosphorylates this protein, CDC25, and it's a complicated mechanism. There are many proteins involved in regulating the activities of these cyclin-dependent kinases. And what we've been doing in the group for many years now is to study mechanisms like this deterministically by converting that wiring diagram into a set of nonlinear ordinary differential equations, just the standard biochemical reaction kinetics, to describe the synthesis and degradation of the cyclin-dependent kinases and of their activators and inhibitors. So a large network like we're talking about creates lots of differential equations with many terms on the right-hand side. And all of these reaction rates are characterized by rate constants and binding constants, and one has to try to estimate from the experimental data what these rate constants are, and then fit the model to experimental observations. And that's a long story that I'm not going to tell today, but I'll just point you to one of the websites on our webpage, the budding yeast model, and you'll find all kinds of gory details about how the models are built, how the parameters are estimated, how the simulations are compared to experimental data. But what I want to talk about today is the progress that we are making in converting these deterministic models into stochastic models. So before we go do all that hard work, we ought to think about why we should bother with stochastic models. What's going to be the use or the payoff to stochastic modeling? Well, first of all, we have to realize that cells are very small and progression through the cell cycle is very noisy. And my first example comes from fission yeast. So these are electron micrographs of fission yeast cells. They're little rod-shaped yeast cells. They're about 14 micrometers long when they divide. They grow in length only. And it's quite easy to observe them under the microscope, observe a whole population of cells, and measure the time they spend in the cell cycle. So that would be their age at division, and also to measure their size at division, cell length at division. And you find the typical distribution of these measurements. So size at division is distributed around an average size, as I said, of about 14 micrometers. And the coefficient of variation for size at division is about 7.5%. Remember, the coefficient of variation is the standard deviation divided by a mean. So it's a dimensionless number, a percentage, that kind of tells you how variable cells are when they divide, how variable in size they are. Age at division, with rich growth conditions, the cycle time is about 110 minutes, the average cycle time, and the coefficient of variation of age at division is about 14%. So there's definitely variability in progression through the cell cycle for yeast cells. And those two distributions indicate to us that cells are not very fussy about how long it takes to do DNA synthesis and mitosis, nor consequently about how large they are at division. And size fluctuations can be corrected in the next generation. So this is a classic experimental measurement done by Peter Fontes, published in 1977. Again, he's working with fission yeast, measuring size and cycle time of populations of cells. And here he's looking at the correlation between cell length at birth and cell cycle time. And what you see is a very clear negative correlation between cell length at birth and cycle time. This is for wild-type cells, and this is for a particular mutant cell that can be made very long at birth. And what you see is a strong negative correlation between size at birth and the time it takes to go through the next cycle. That means that cells that are very small at birth have a long cycle time before they will divide. And cells that are very large at birth have a relatively short cycle time. And that means that they kind of make up for their sizes in the next cycle. So if you're very small at birth, but then you have a long cycle time before you divide yourself, you're going to be larger than normal when you finally divide. And conversely, if you're very large when you're born, you have a short cycle time and you'll be a little bit smaller. So there's a regression to the mean in the next cycle. Okay? So cells aren't very fussy about how long it takes to do the cell cycle or how large they are, because they can make up for some of these deviations in the next cell cycle. Yeah. Well, so remember, there's a well-defined average size at division. The average size at division is about 14 or 15 micrometers. So the average size at birth is around 7 or 7.5 micrometers. This is for all the cells in a population, okay? But there's a distribution in the population, so some cells are born small, some cells are born large, depending upon the size of their mother, but there's a regression towards the mean. And this regression towards the mean is indicated by this strong negative correlation between cycle time and birth size. Well, I haven't told you where the noise comes from, right? I'm just trying to convince you that there is noise and that it's important and that cells have to deal with the noise, okay? But, you know, we'll talk about where the noise is coming from in a sec, okay? But I need to establish this fact, first of all, that cells aren't very fussy about how old they are or how big they are when they divide. What they're fussy about, of course, is that they very accurately replicate the DNA molecules and then very precisely separate the sister chromatids, the replicated DNA molecules, to the two daughter cells. That's what they're fussy about. That's what's important. How long that takes and consequently how big they are when they divide is of lesser importance. But they do correct for it because they do have well-defined distributions of size at division and age at division. Okay, and there's one other figure from Fonte's paper that I need, and that is the correlation between cell length at division N and cell length at division N plus 1. So this is looking for any correlation between size at division of the mother cell, cycle N, and size at division of the daughter cell at division N plus 1, and what you see is that there is no correlation. Okay? Cell size at division is uncorrelated from mother cells to daughter cells. So this line is flat. If cells are very large at division, then you begin to see some correlation, but that's only seen in mutant cells that are unusually large because of the way they've been prepared. Okay? But for normal cells down in this region, there's no correlation between division size of mother and daughter cells. They forget how big they are. It's very important how big they are at birth, which tells you how big your mother was, but by the time you get to division, you've forgotten how big you were at birth, and you've forgotten how big your mother was. Two sequential divisions. This is division of the mother, and this is division of the daughter. Of course, I'll say it again. The daughter's birth size depends very much on the mother's division size. It's half the mother's division size. But by the time the daughter cell divides herself, she's forgotten how big her mother was. That means she's forgotten how big she was at birth. Division size is not correlated to birth size.
The division size of two sequential populations should be look exactly the same, right? They should be, if you change X and Y, it should be
If you just gather a population of cells and don't look at their relationships to each other, and then just plot the histogram of size, you get you get this well-defined histogram. Let's back up. Oops, going the wrong direction. Okay, so you just take a population of cells and look at the histogram of size. It's a nice distribution with a mean of 14 micrometers and a coefficient of variation 7.5%. Now we want to look at correlations between cells. And the first correlation we see is a strong negative correlation between size at birth and the length of the next cycle. That negative correlation helps cells to regress back to the mean. But when we look at the actual size at division of the daughter compared to the mother, there's no correlation. They're uncorrelated. And that's reflected in the fact that the interpretation of these experiments is that the cells are trying to maintain some kind of an average cell size. And they have a size control checkpoint in the cell cycle. That was one of the conclusions of this paper. And remember, this is 1977. This is a long time ago, you know? Most of you weren't born. And the conclusion was that somewhere in the molecular machinery, cells are sensitive to size, and they're trying to regulate their size. And they try, there's some kind of a critical size checkpoint in the cell cycle. Okay, you with me? Now, let's try to understand that a little bit more detail. So I just diagrammed here. So this would be a lineage. Here's a cell that divides, and here's the daughter cell, a certain size at birth. The cell grows exponentially in time until the cycle is finished, and then divides in half and grows again. So that would be a lineage of cells. The time between divisions is the cell cycle time, or I'll also call that the age at division. It's how old a cell is when she divides. And if the cells are growing exponentially, which is actually a very good assumption when you look at how cells grow, then the size of a cell at division is just the size at birth times e to the mu times age at division. And mu is the specific growth rate for the increase in size. Yes? No, it's... cultures grow exponentially, but cells do as well. When you go and measure individual cells, especially yeast cells, This has an experimental foundation. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. It isn't obvious, but it's true. Okay. So, again, ancient history, even more ancient. In 1962, Koch and Schechter were thinking about the implications of exponential growth and division of bacterial cells. And they presented this nice little model to relate the age distribution and the size distribution. And it's a simple argument. You take this relationship between size of division, size of birth, and age of division, okay? And you find, of course, the age of division is the logarithm of the ratio of the sizes. But the size of a cell at birth is one half the size of the mother cell at division. Okay? So we have this identity between age at division and size at division. But this is size of the dividing cell, and that's the size of the mother cell that gave birth to this cell. But remember, I've argued that these two random variables are uncorrelated. The size at division of the daughter cell is uncorrelated to the size at division of the mother cell. And therefore, we can use the properties of variances of uncorrelated random variables, of independent random variables, to say that from this equation, mu times the standard deviation of age at division is the square root of twice the variance of the log of the size at division. And it's not hard to show that that's a relationship between coefficient of variation of age at division and coefficient of variation of size at division. And in particular, Koch and Schechter showed that the coefficient of variation of age at division is roughly twice the coefficient of variation of size at division. And if you remember, that was exactly true for yeast cells. Age of division, 14%, size of division, 7.5%. And for lots of different bacterial cells, populations that had been measured at the time of Koch and Schechter's paper, they noticed this connection, this twofold difference in the coefficients of variation, which is what stimulated this little theoretical argument back in 1962. Okay? A very nice example of old-fashioned theoretical biology. Yes. Well, it's empirical relationship that these two coefficients of variation are about twofold different. It's an empirical relationship, and this is the theoretical foundation of the relationship. It just comes from the fact that cells grow exponentially. There's a certain random component to the division, so that size and age are random variables. And the third thing that you need is this non-correlation of size at division of mother cells and daughter cells. So from those three facts, you get this relationship. Okay? Very interesting. And remember that the fact that these sizes at division are uncorrelated suggests that there's some point in the middle of the cell cycle where the cells are trying to get to some critical checkpoint mass. That's why they forget how big they were at birth, because they're all trying to achieve some kind of a standard size somewhere in the middle of the cell cycle. That was Koch and Schechter's interpretation in 1962. Okay.
Was the logic for saying they are uncorrelated was proved in 1937 for that?
Their logic, well, okay, I didn't look up the bacterial data, but I'm sure you'll find in the bacterial literature the same non-correlation between mothers and daughters. But since the rest of the paper is going to be about yeast and eukaryotes, I didn't want to rely too heavily on information from prokaryotes. Okay? This is a little bit out of historical sequence. Okay, so we can ask, what's to explain? That gives a pretty nifty little explanation of the basic facts about variability in size and age at division of populations of bacteria and yeast cells and even mammalian cells show many of these characteristics. But this is a kind of phenomenological theory of the stochastic nature of cell cycle progression. And by now, we have a lot more information about the underlying molecular biology and some of the underlying molecular characterization of single cells, especially eukaryotic cells, especially yeast. Okay? So one thing that we have to deal with is this recent information about the numbers of molecules per haploid yeast cell for several cell cycle genes. So this comes from high-throughput kind of investigations of the yeast genome as to how many proteins there are in a cell, how many messenger RNA molecules there are. And it's not a surprise, for all these cell cycle genes in yeast, the average number of protein molecules per cell is anywhere from a few hundred to a few thousand molecules per cell. So that's probably what you would have guessed. What came as a big surprise is the average number of messenger RNA molecules per cell for these genes, which is on the order of one or two molecules, sometimes less than one molecule per cell on average. So the mRNA levels are very low, much lower than most of us would have guessed. This is an asynchronous population, so the cells have spread all different phases in the cell cycle. You just collect them, grind them up, measure mRNA and protein, and divide by the number of cells. This is, like you say, you take a bunch of cells, you grind them up, count the mRNA molecules. Yes, yes, yes they are. Kathy, do you know? Cross's measurements, I know, were done with labeled antibodies. So you grind up the cells, you bind to the you label them with HA tags, you bind with antibodies against HA and quantify. Yeah. Yes. On all proteins. On single cells, yeah. Cell microscopy, yeah. Then yeah. Okay. Okay.
But the mRNA, I don't know. I would not be so sure about the mRNA numbers going away. Said what still might equally be 1.2. Because the error.
Well, yeah, okay, there's certainly error, but it's on the order of one molecule rather than 100 molecules. Definitely, okay? Now, okay, so what are the implications of this? Well, just kind of rule of thumb. People thinking about stochastic fluctuations in mRNAs and proteins. You expect the coefficient of variation of protein levels to be the square root of the reciprocal of the average number of protein molecules. That's just a rule of thumb for molecular fluctuation. And if there's 1,000 protein molecules on average, the coefficient of variation would be about 3%, which is, you know, it's enough to cause 5-10% variation in progression through the cell cycle. So that's kind of reassuring. That's what we all expected to see. The problem is the very low numbers of messenger RNAs, and these same people, Peter Swain, Johan Paulsen, and a number of other physical chemists, thinking about the process of transcription and translation, show that if you take into account the gene expression and the messenger RNA encoding the protein, then the coefficient of variation of the protein level depends not only on the average number of protein molecules, but also on the average number of messenger RNA molecules. And that's weighted by the ratio of the half-life of the messenger RNA to the half-life of the protein. And if you just assume, for lack of better knowledge, that messenger RNA molecules and protein molecules have about the same half-life, maybe 15 minutes, half an hour, or something like that, then what do we get for a coefficient of variation? This is 1/2, that's 1/1, it's completely dominated by the messenger RNA, and the coefficient of variation of the protein level is a whopping 70%, completely dominated by the high noise in the messenger RNA. Because the messenger RNA population has to be amplified many times to make that much protein from that little bit of messenger RNA. So this looks like we could be in real trouble. How are we going to account for any kind of reliability and progression through the cell cycle if the protein variability is 70%? Well, I mean, this is what we're going to try to work out. And I'll tell you right now, we can't answer this question. This question is still going to be left hanging at the end, but hopefully we'll at least have a little bit better understanding of why it's a problem. Because now what we want to do is build a realistic model of the molecular control system with realistic numbers for messenger RNAs and proteins and rate constants, and see what the intrinsic and extrinsic noise sources are going to give us for variability in cell cycle. Yes?
About this estimation. So that the number of mRNAs average over the whole cell cycle,
yeah,
for the population, I think.
Yeah.
For the instance number of RNAs can be big.
No.
If
the mRNAs are periodic during the cell cycle, some genes are expressed periodically, then it's certainly true that you could have lots of mRNA molecules at some phases when the gene's being expressed and zero for long times when the gene isn't being expressed. That's true. That could help. Okay? But there are many genes that control the cell cycle that are synthesized constitutively during the cell cycle. Okay? And for those, you can't get around this. You still have a lot. Yeah. Okay? So this is a big problem that we have to address, even if we can't solve it. Okay, another reason why we want to build stochastic simulations is because some mutants of yeast show very curious and very strange cell cycle properties. So for instance, this double mutant of fission yeast shows a trimodal distribution of cycle times. So this is a histogram of cycle times for that yeast cell, and you see a lot of the population has a short cycle time of 90 minutes or so, and then a third of the population has a cycle time of 160 minutes, and there are even 10% or so of the population with a very long cycle time. And if you follow individual cells, they switch between these different populations. So a cell might have a short cycle, and then a long cycle, and then an intermediate cycle. Very strange behavior. Never going to account for that or explain for that in terms of a deterministic model, because in a deterministic model, the cells are all going to do exactly the same thing. Unless you have a chaotic solution, I guess, to the deterministic equations, but we never see that sort of behavior. Much more likely is there's noise in the system, and the control system is sensitive to noise, and sometimes they can divide, and sometimes they skip that division, have to wait for a second or third try. And the third reason why we want to build stochastic models is because more and more now we're able to do single-cell measurements on yeast cells and mammalian cells, all kinds of cells, using fluorescently labeled proteins. This is an example from Cross's lab, where a protein called WSKI5 has been labeled with green fluorescent protein, and you can see the WSKI5 moving from the cytoplasm into the nucleus and back into the cytoplasm again. So you can make very accurate measurements of individual proteins, find out where they are in the cell, count how many proteins there are. We're getting more and more of this kind of data. And in fact, Jean Picot's lab is has been gearing itself up to make exactly these kinds of measurements on yeast cells, on wild-type cells, and on mutant cells. So we hope to have lots of this data, and we need models to handle this sort of data. Okay? So, where's the noise coming from? We suspect that there are two sources of noise in cell cycle progression. Intrinsic noise, which refers to molecular fluctuations in the control network, in the interactions among these proteins and messenger RNA molecules. And then there are extrinsic sources of noise, which are basically inequities in the division process. Because when a cell divides, we say it, say a fission yeast cell divides in half, but they don't divide exactly in half. There's a bit of a slop to that process, about a 5% coefficient of variation of the division process. And since things are sensitive to how big a cell is when it's born, you have to take into account that extrinsic source of noise. And also, when a cell divides, the molecular components have to be partitioned between the two daughter cells. And the DNA is very accurately partitioned. Each cell gets exactly one copy of the genome, but all the proteins are partitioned randomly between the two daughter cells, and one should take that into account as well. Okay.